You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including the appointment of new Josephine County commissioners, the transfer of property to tribes in Humboldt County, and the final draft of Oregon's offshore wind energy roadmap. I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, science, and environment reporter.
Roman, we're going to start with you. You've got some good news after months of chaos at the Josephine County Board of Commissioners. What happened this week?
Yeah, they finally appointed two people to the Board of Commissioners. It's been a long time. They've been basically without a functioning Board of Commissioners for months, weeks, long time. Two commissioners were recalled recently, Andreas Bleck back in December and Chris Barnett in January. And according to county code, if there isn't a quorum on this three-person board, then a temporary board of the other elected officials gets to decide who gets appointed into those seats. So they've been doing that for a few weeks. They got 37 applications for the positions. They whittled it down to five finalists last week. But that ended up changing to nine finalists that they actually interviewed because state law has a thing where if you're a veteran, you get special preference for interviews, which means you get extra points and you also have to be interviewed for the job. So they interviewed all of them on Wednesday, and then they finally decided yesterday. I was there. It was kind of boring. They just basically like counted up a bunch of sheets where they had scores on them. But they ended up picking two people, Colleen Martin and Gary Richardson.
So sort of anticlimactic. What can you tell us about the two appointees?
Yeah. So both have previously ran for county commissioner before. Ironically, they are actually both appointed to fill the seats that were left vacant by the recalled people they ran against and lost. So interesting. Gary Richardson is the longest serving member on the Grants Pass School Board. He's an engineer by trade. He ran for commissioner in 2022 and lost to John West. John West was eventually recalled and then replaced by Andreas Bleck, who was also then recalled. And now Gary Richardson will be in the seat. He also spent time in this collaborative economic development committee for Grants Pass in the county. So he has a lot of governmental experience and experience with budgets because the county's going to have to pass a budget this spring. And the Grants Pass School District actually has a larger budget than the county itself. Mm-hmm. So has experience with that. Colleen Martin is a businesswoman and a real estate agent. She also ran in 2024 against Chris Barnett, who was recalled in January. She has kind of more non-governmental organization experience. She was the CEO of the Grants Pass and Josephine County Chamber of Commerce. And then she also worked at the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce. So a lot of like business, economic side experience. They both say they'll work well together, bring back some stability to the county. I know that they both had mentioned they want to work on economic revitalization for the county.
So some irony in who the final choices yeah. were. You said you listened to 8 hours of interviews with the nine finalists on Wednesday. Were there any themes that you noticed?
Yeah. One of the questions that I paid attention to the most was to list two successes and two failures in the county in the past 2 years and what they do to fix those failures. And I noticed some themes there. One common answer was the Grants Pass library lease. Right before John West left office, he pushed through this motion to terminate the library lease, which would have meant they'd be kicked out in 30 days. They ended up not getting kicked out, but it was part of an effort to renegotiate the lease to be more in the county's favor. But it was very tense from the start, and the negotiations took almost a whole year, and they finally approved a new lease in September. That lease itself was also a reason for the recall against Bleck and Barnett. Another failure I noticed was giving Andreas Bleck sole hiring and firing authority for the county during a period of time in early last year. A lot of the finalists thought it was irresponsible on the part of the other two commissioners that they're elected to lead the county, so they should be leading the county and not delegating that authority to one person. And it kind of broke trust with county staff. So both Martin and Richardson say they want to slow things down and look at stuff more carefully and also build some buy-in with the community and the county staff and explain their decisions better.
So both of these appointees are taking over not a full term. They're taking over midway. So are either of them planning on running for election to fill the seat past this year?
Yeah. Colleen Martin told me that she is planning on running now. Both appointees are going to be in the seat till the end of the year, and then there's going to be elections. There's a May primary and a November election to fill both of those seats. Colleen Martin's going to face off against Simon Hare, who's currently filed. He's a former county commissioner and also was one of the finalists interviewed. Richardson told me he hasn't decided, but he's leaning towards no. That seat that he's in will be There are three people running. Two of them are the two people who are most recently recalled, Andreas Bleck and John West. And then there's a third candidate, Tracy Thompson, who ran for state senate as a Democrat in 2024 and lost. So it sounds like he might not be running in that position, but there are a bunch of other candidates for that one.
That's interesting. Thanks, Roman. Justin, we're going to turn to you. You reported on a decision from the California Coastal Commission about a property with a history of permit violations. That decision was pretty unique. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this decision was to approve the transfer of a property in Humboldt County to Wyatt Area Tribes. And like you mentioned, that was after a long fight over the owner's violations of permit requirements. And at least in Humboldt County, this is likely the first time we've kind of had this result, the transfer to local tribes. The California Coastal Commission regulates land use and development along the entire coastline. They're a big regulatory body, and the commissioners really celebrated this decision. They referred to it in the terms of land back and environmental justice. You know, the property in question is it was a large unfinished home near Humboldt Bay. It was being built by a local developer who started it way back in 2018. And he started under some conditions from Humboldt County because of the area's sensitive ecological and cultural aspects. And during the construction, he did not follow all of those rules. So the California Coastal Commission eventually took an interest and kind of flexed their authority here.
Okay, so you say he did not follow the rules. What kind of permit violations are we talking about?
Right, so Humboldt County planners originally approved an 8,000-square-foot residence, so pretty big, but property grew to over 21,000 square feet,
wow.
So nearly three times as much. A section of the home also encroached onto a protected wetland buffer area. An unauthorized road removed native vegetation, especially blackberry. And the county actually issued a stop work order back in 2021 after they became aware of these violations. But construction continued. The land, you know, it's good to mention that the land where this house was being built is the site of a historic Wyatt village, which is pretty culturally important to the area tribes. You know, there was a worry that the non-approved construction would harm artifacts or things that the tribes hold sacred around there. So according to the California Coastal Commission report, a report they released, there's actually, quote, there's no other known or similar site in the Humboldt Bay region that contains such uniquely well-preserved cultural materials. So it's a big claim, although the commission declined to disclose, you know, the location or nature of those cultural materials.
Okay, so now the tribes get the property?
Yeah, the tribes will get that property. And it's kind of an incredible outcome. So it took years of negotiation, but the result is that the home must be demolished, the land put back into its original state, and then transferred to one or all three of the local Wyatt people tribes in the area. The property owner must also pay $400,000 in fines and, like I mentioned, restore the land to its previous condition and fund tribal monitors to observe this whole process. So the commissioners really celebrated this decision, and it was interesting listening to this commission meeting where they approved the settlement, because I feel like they might have went a little too far during their celebration. And at one point, the attorney of this property, you know, spoke up, and he said, look, I agree with the settlement, but he wanted to make some things clear. He noted that an archaeologist did visit the site and produced a report that was accepted by the tribe that said construction did not result in any destruction of cultural resources, mm-hmm. like artifacts or anything. The home's increase in square footage also was due to a second level, so the property's footprint effectively remained the same besides that road they built. And he also noted the house was constructed on the site of a former quarry that had been excavated. So there's no evidence that this construction destroyed protected wetland. So I found that interesting that he pushed back. You know, the California Coastal Commission has been criticized lately, including from the governor of California, Governor Gavin Newsom, for sort of over-regulating for holding up housing supply. And I'm sure there will be some who look at the settlement as indicative of sort of a heavy hand. But the local area tribes seem very happy with this decision.
Yeah, it's a complicated situation. Thanks, Justin. Roman, going back to you, you also reported on the release of the final draft of the Oregon Offshore Wind Energy Roadmap. First, what is that?
Yeah, it's this big guide that is designed to help the state better position itself to be prepared for offshore wind off the Oregon coast. Lawmakers ordered it back in 2024. I talked to Jeff Burright at the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development, who's kind of been leading this whole thing. It was created at the time because the federal government was looking to lease some areas for offshore wind off the southern Oregon coast, and a lot of people were opposed to that, including the state. They felt like the process was moving too fast and there wasn't enough public input, and the state wasn't ready for this, hence this roadmap to kind of get them to be prepared. But those leases didn't end up going through. Most of the developers backed out, and then the feds also dropped that sale when Trump took office.
So your reporting mentions this plan is different from other offshore wind roadmaps in other states. How?
Yeah, so other states like California and New York have their own, but they're more straightforward. They sort of just say, hey, what are the barriers preventing us from deploying offshore wind? And they sort of look at it as if it's inevitable. But the Oregon plan looks at different futures of, like, what if the state chooses not to have offshore wind at all? Or what if they just contribute to it economically, like bringing some of the supply chain up here to bring stuff down to California? So it has kind of recommendations for all those scenarios. And then as you go up the ladder of more and more participation in offshore wind, the previous recommendations also apply. So it kind of outlines that. And then it also has the whole federal process and identifies different checkpoints in that process where the state can stop and reevaluate things and decide if it needs to take a pause or, you know, change lanes or something like that.
Oh, that's interesting. So what are some of the recommendations in the roadmap?
Yeah, some are related to state policies or laws. Burright told me how the state policy that's used to analyze offshore energy projects was written with wave energy in mind, not offshore wind. There's also things looking at energy infrastructure, more research, especially in the coastal communities that, you know, since they're more remote, can face more power outages. So ensuring that those communities actually benefit from having these offshore wind turbines right near their homes. And then also another big thing was looking at community benefit agreements, codifying and enforcing them, and providing more resources to communities to be able to negotiate these agreements that communities sign with the developers to bring more benefits to these areas. So there's a lot of other recommendations too.
Yeah. And so how can our listeners look at the roadmap and make a comment on it?
Yeah, there's a link to the specific page on the Department of Land Conservation Development website on our story on IJPR.org. This is the final draft. It's going to be up for public comment until April 3rd. Burright told me he's just kind of looking to see if they missed anything, if there's any other recommendations that could, you know, help bring benefits to the state. And then you can also find ways to leave comments on that website. It's going to go back to this offshore wind roundtable to look at it after the public comment, and then he's hopefully getting it to the legislature by the summer.
Okay, great. Justin, you also had a story on a big update to how we treat ONC lands in Oregon. What are ONC lands, and what is the change?
Yeah, so really quickly, I'm sure this is probably something most of our listeners already know, but ONC lands, they include around 2.5 million acres of federally managed forests within 18 counties in Oregon. And basically, way back in the 30s, it was decided that the feds would allow sustained yield timber harvesting on that land, which means cutting down up to as much timber that grows each year and sell that timber and then split the revenue with the counties that have this land. Recently, the Department of the Interior increase the county share of those receipts. That was good news for the counties. But this is how services in a number of Oregon counties were largely paid for in the past. That allowed counties to have some pretty low property taxes in Oregon because they got this timber revenue. But that sort of fell apart in the 90s when we had these conservation efforts that stopped a lot of those logging. So now the BLM is proposing to change what's called the resource management plan for these ONC lands and potentially quadruple the amount of logging allowed on ONC lands, aiming for harvesting around 1 billion board feet annually compared to around last year we harvested around 250 million board feet.
Oh, interesting. Okay, we've only got about 30 seconds left, but can you tell me a little bit about the feelings on this decision?
Yeah, so the counties largely and industry groups are celebrating it. They say it'll bring back jobs, also revenue for these counties who are struggling financially. Conservationists are raising the alarm. They say increasing logging will raise wildfire risks. harm, you know, habitat for animals, harm water quality. So this is a pretty big fight that's coming. But, you know, at least the ONC counties, the commissioners especially, are celebrating this decision.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.